Nick Cave has been performing music for more than 30 years, most famously as lead singer of the band Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds. He sat down with Steve Paulson to talk about songwriting and his second novel, The Death of Bunny Monroe. Steve Paulson asked him if he felt he had more freedom writing a novel than with a song.
Absolutely. You know, I mean, I'm much more suited to writing a novel than I am a song because I'm naturally expansive. You know, I find it very difficult to let go of an idea. And to a fault, I think, for me, my songs always feel like they're kind of bursting at the seams. You can actually invent your own character in a novel, which for me is, because my songs are narrative songs, they need characters. And so I deal in kind of archetypes, because if you're writing a song, you have no time to develop a character. So very often my characters are called things like Lazarus or Orpheus or people that already have some kind of personality attached to them and then subvert it and do something different with it.
Orpheus sat gloomy in his garden shed, wondering what to do with a lump of wood and a piece of wire and a little pot of glue. Oh, mama. He sawed the wood with half a heart, and he glued it top to bottom. He strung a wire in between, he was feeling something rotten. Oh, mama.
The way you wrote this novel, The Death of Bunny Monroe, was kind of unusual. Didn't you actually write it on a music tour? I mean, sort of like late at night and on the bus?
That's right. The kind of wisdom in rock and roll is that you can't do anything creative on tour. You can do the show in the evening, and the rest of the time you're a vegetable that's sort of chaperoned from place to place and city to city, and then you go and do this show. I wondered if that was actually true in some kind of way, and I started writing this novel on the bus, on the tour bus, under unbelievably chaotic conditions. It was an amazing way to write, actually. It made that tour very different from any other tour that I've been on before, that's for sure.
What about this particular character, Bunny Monroe? How did you come up with this guy?
I wonder. I don't know how I came up with it, but basically what I wanted to do was to create a monster that we recognized ourselves in. Valerie Solanas' Scum Manifesto, I don't know if you've ever read that. She was the woman who shot Andy Warhol, and she wrote a wonderful kind of screed against maleness that described incredibly beautifully and very angrily what she thought the male personality was like. And that, I think, informed, I mean, A, I thought that it was kind of correct that we were these kind of lumpen masses of predatory sexual drive, incarnate walking around. That very much inspired the actual character, I think.
This guy who just lives and breathes sex. As one review of your book described him, Bunny is a fornication machine. Is that a fair description?
Nice. Well, he wants to be a fornication machine. He's not always successful, unfortunately, for him. I think he thinks he's a lot better at it than he actually is. Bunny empties the tiny bottle of vodka down his throat, lights another cigarette, and rises from the bed. The room heaves as Bunny is hit by the realization that he is very drunk. With arms held out to the side and on tiptoe, Bunny moonwalks across the room to the window. He lurches, stumbles, and Tarzans the faded chintz curtains until he finds his balance and steadies himself. He draws them open extravagantly, and the vulcanized daylight and the screaming of birds deranges the room. Bunny's pupils contract painfully as he grimaces through the window into the light. He sees a dark cloud of starlings twittering madly over the flaming, smoking hulk of the West Pier that stands helpless in the sea across from the hotel. He wonders why he hadn't seen this before, and then wonders how long he has been in this room, then remembers his wife and hears her say, "Bunny, are you there?" "Yeah," says Bunny, transfixed by the sight of the burning pier and the thousand screaming birds. Bunny moves back to the bed and can hear his wife crying on the end of the phone. 10 years, he thinks, 10 years, and those tears still get him. And he lays back against the headboard and bats ape-like at his genitals and says, I'll be back tomorrow, babe, early. Do you love me, Bun? Says Libby. You know I do. Do you swear on your life? Upon Christ and all his saints, right down to your little shoes, baby. Can't you get home tonight? I would if I could, says Bunny, scrambling around on the bed for his cigarettes, but I'm miles away. Oh, Bunny, you f***ing liar. The line goes dead, and Bunny says, Lib, you got your hands full there, darling. With great effort, Bunny turns his head and looks at the prostitute standing in the doorway of the bathroom.
We should talk just a little bit about the arc of the story. Early on, Bunny's wife commits suicide. I mean, he has totally neglected her, and then he suddenly has charge of their 9-year-old son, and he doesn't know what to do with this kid, but sort of has to figure it out. Tell us what happens after that.
He will not accept any responsibility for his wife's death, and he can't bear to stay in the house any longer, so he goes on the road. He does what he does, and he goes on the road, selling his beauty products and taking his 9-year-old boy along with him. The 9-year-old boy sits in the car while his father goes into these houses and tries to somehow obliterate himself through the women that he meets. That kind of goes on for a while. Episodically. And as his life unravels and goes down the toilet, I would say that's pretty much what happens.
So is sex his path to escape love? I mean, it seems like he's running away from love.
Well, exactly. Yeah, he's trying to find a woman that he can kind of crawl inside where love won't find him. There you go. And it's structurally based loosely on the Gospel of Mark from the Bible, which is utterly obsessed with the death of Christ.
Now, of course, what happens in the Gospels is that Christ dies so that he can redeem humanity. And I suppose that's kind of the story in your novel as well. Bunny has to die so that his son, Bunny Jr., can get on with his life, right?
Yeah, there is that aspect to it, but it's in no way, for me, it wasn't intended to be your normal redemptive novel in the sense that you have a flawed character and that character sees the error of his ways and makes amends and everyone lives happily ever after. I don't really buy that or find that it's necessary to be redeemed or saved. Bunny's does die unredeemed, if you like, if we're going to talk about it in those terms, in the sense that his life is over in an instant, you know. But he is capable of inspiring love, this monstrous man, through the eyes of his 9-year-old son, who Bunny Jr. can only see his father in a godlike way, yeah.
Hi, Dad, says the boy. You got a suitcase, says Bunny. I don't know, Dad. Well, find one, says Bunny, flinging his arms out to the sides in mock exasperation. Haven't I taught you anything? What for, Dad? What do you mean, what for? What do I need a suitcase for? Says the boy, thinking, he's sending me away, and he feels the wind rush out of him. Well, what do you think you need a bloody suitcase for? Says Bunny. Am I going somewhere? Says the boy, jumping from foot to foot and wiping his forehead with the back of his hand. Not I, says Bunny. We. We? Yeah. Where are we going, Dad? We are hitting the road, says Bunny, cocking a thumb and jerking it over his shoulder in the general direction of the outside world. Really? Says the boy, smiling so much that his teeth show. Really? Says Bunny. But you can't go looking like a bloody hobo. It's the first rule of salesmanship. Be presentable. Just you and me, Dad? Says the boy, peeling off the T-shirt, balling it up and pitching it across the room. Just you and me, Bunny boy.
The good son walks into the field. He is a tiller. He has a tiller's hand. But deeper down in his heart now, he's a laid down queer plans against his brother and against his family. Yet he worshipped his brother, and he worshipped his mother. But it's his father, he says, is an unfair man. The good son, a good son.
You know, the characters in my songs are looked through a kind of prism of violence, because I think it's a fundamental part of our nature, and it's in the same way as what I tried to put in the character of Bunny Munro through the male personality and psyche. There is a kind of seam of predatory sexuality that exists in our kind of reptilian brains, and that's what I wanted male readers, and actually female readers who've come to me and said, you know, we always suspected men were like Bunny Munro, thank you for finally admitting it, that we could recognize this aspect of ourselves in it. Obviously, we don't behave like Bunny Munro, and we have developed ways to negotiate society and live within society effectively, or attempt to live within society effectively. But, you know, I think that there is this element that lives deep within us that is just there.
Nick Cave's the author of The Death of Bunny Munro. He's best known as the lead singer of the band Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds. Steve Paulson spoke with him.